Good morning, everybody. Shmuel Platz coming at you live from the Lubavitch Yeshiva. Once again, had the privilege of helping to make a minion here. You can't fight a 9:30 a.m. shacharis. That is like glorious. I mean, even if you go to sleep late, you're still going to get a good night's sleep, and you'll still get here in time. How could you not? I mean, 9:30, that's pretty good. So I had the pleasure and privilege of doing that, and let's get right into it. Welcome to Introduction to Talmud 101 to the Gofman Synagogue School of Jewish Studies. And thank you very much to Jake and Mitch for all they do at sheerenjoyment.com for publishing our classes on their website. We're very, very grateful. Mitch said the other day that maybe there was some echoing going on in the classroom that I sat in the other day. So I'm in a bigger space right now. Hopefully there's no echo. I'm like in the lobby area here at the Lubavitch Yeshiva here in Cincinnati. And therefore, without further ado, let's get right into our material. Today's going to be just a great, super interesting, fun class. The Agadita is great, and we'll take a bite out of, we're on 4A in Tainus. We're already on 4A, thank God. It's moving along nicely. So let's get right to it. And if you're with me inside the Hebrew, then it's famous Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonason. Where's that? There it is. Okay, so it's like 10, maybe 10 lines from the very, very top of 4A. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. 14 lines from the very top on 4A in Tainus. Here we go. Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonason, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani said the name of Rabbi Yonason, Shlosha Sha'alu Kahogan. We're going to be introduced to a piece of Agadot over here. You're going to say to yourself, what is this? What's it got to do with rain? What's it got to do with anything? And the answer is, much of it doesn't have to really do with what we're doing, except the very, very tail end. At the very, very end of today's class, there you're going to see a reference to rain. And therefore, that's going to tie it all together. But you have to be patient. You got to be patient. This is a Jewish text. Shalosh 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 Kahogan. Three individuals made requests, Shalosh Kahogan, in a way that wasn't right, in an improper manner. I don't know if it's chutzpahdik, but it was in a way that you don't normally ask for things like that. And you're going to see the examples as to why the rabbis felt like that. Three individuals made requests in an improper manner. The Shnayim Hishivuhu Kahogan. Out of the three of them, two were still at all answered, you know, properly, acceptably, appropriately, that kind of thing. But the Almighty answered their prayer in a good, upstanding, proper, positive way. The Echad Hashivuhu Shalom Kahogan. One, however, was answered in an improper or inappropriate or unhappy kind of a way. The ending is not going to be so great. The Eluhain, and here they are. Here are the three people who asked for stuff in a way that maybe they should not have asked it. Eliezer, Eved Avraham. Eliezer, the servant of Abraham. Yishol ben Kish, the famous King Shaul, and Saul, the son of Kish, for Yiftach HaGaladi, and Yiftach, the Gileadite. And these are three who asked for stuff in a way that is less than optimal, less than appropriate. Let's go see the examples of how they asked for something in an inappropriate manner. Eliezer, Abed Avraham. Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, how did he ask for something in a way that was not 100% proper? How did he phrase it that the rabbis could be critical? Okay, he made an improper request when he was seeking a wife for Yitzchak, Avraham Avinu's son. He asked for something, Shalot Hogan, in a way that was not ideal or optimal. Yachsev, because it's written, and here are the words of Eliezer, V'haya ha-na'ara asher omar eleha hatina kadeich. So let it be, this is Eliezer praying to God, let it be that the maiden to whom I shall say, please tip over your jug that I may drink. And if she replies, drink, and I'll even give your waters drink, then blessed be the one whom you have designated for your servant of Yitzchak. That was the prayer that Eliezer, servant of Abraham, made. Let it be that the maiden to whom I shall say, She's tip over your jug so I may drink. And if she replies, drink and I'll even water your camels. So then let her be the one who's destined to be the wife of Yitzchak. End of the biblical citation over there. Now, by the way, where is that if you want to look it up? Genesis 24. It's in Bereishis 24, verse 14. Okay, now, in what way was that inappropriate? How is it that that the language that he used is less than optimal? So the Talmud will explain it to you. Yocho, afilu chigeret, afilu suma. You're saying that the girl who says, I'll give you drink and I'll give you camels to drink. Says the Talmud, is it possible that he meant to take even a lame girl or a blind girl as a wife for Yitzchak? That's an amazing thing. In today's time, if you said it like that, you'd be violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. You'd be violating various DEI initiatives and offices. That's insane. You mean to think that he was going to take a lame girl for Yitzchak or a blind girl? And your response would be, a lame girl could be a very nice girl. A blind girl could be a very nice girl. let me read you a footnote. In his prayer to God, Eliezer did not specifically exclude a lame girl or a blind girl. Consequently, if such a person would have been the first to respond to his request in the prescribed manner, and Eliezer failed to recognize her deformity, he would have taken her as a wife for Yitzchak. He would have wound up taking a girl with a deformity, with some sort of disability, as a wife for Yitzchak, and that would not be optimal. The only problem with this line of thinking and this line of reasoning is that, well, this is what the Talmud was asking. You mean to say a lame girl, he might have taken a lame, L-A-M-E, somebody who's not well on her legs, on her feet, not able to walk properly. You mean he might have taken her as a wife? And I'm thinking, wait a second. You think a lame girl is going to be able to say the words, yes, I'll give you to drink and I'll even water your camels? Do you realize how much water was involved in watering the camels? I would have thought that a lame girl would not bite that off in order to chew it. In other words, that's just way too much work for a lame girl to say, I'll be happy to give water to all your camels. Because you have to realize camels are thirsty animals. And they can put it away. They can drink like an Irishman. I mean, it's a lot of water to give to a bunch of camels. And how would a lame girl undertake that? And if he would have seen her kind of walking the way, listen, I'm not mocking, but the way some lame people walk, where they kind of walk side to side, he probably would have seen that immediately. And I don't know if he would have, in his mind, he's not looking for a lame girl. And in his prayer, he is effectively excluding a lame girl, it seems to me. When he says, let her say, drink and even water your camels. So even in the tefillah that Eliezer is making, it seems to me that he is effectively excluding a lame girl. Because how could he expect a lame girl to undertake that? So he's praying against getting a lame girl. And if that's true, can I argue that? That he's davening, he shouldn't have a lame girl. So how could the Talmud have the question, no, even what if a lame girl would have come on the scene? No, he's praying that a lame girl not come on the scene. He is actually praying that a lame person not come along. So what's the Gemara's question? Oh, what if a lame girl would have come along? He would have taken her. How could he have taken her? He was praying that a healthy girl would come along and water the camels. Only a healthy girl has the ability to do all that kind of work. And you might say, no, even a lame girl could do it. Yeah, not so fast. I mean, come on, let's be reasonable now. At least I'm going to be sticking to it. Sheer enjoyment's calling her. No, maybe not. Some scammer from Bangladesh story. We continue. Okay, still in awe. Hashivo Kehogan. But the fact of the matter is that the Almighty, even if the request wasn't so optimal and there was some leeway there for the Almighty to send a lame girl, and theoretically he could have, But still, Hashem sent the right one. Hashem sent Rivka Imenu, and she was healthy, and she was able to do all the heavy lifting of the water for Eliezer and his men and the camels and everything. So everything worked out great, and Eliezer wound up with a healthy young lady for Yitzchak. By the way, there's an old little joke that I always like to say, that after Nati Horowitz of Israel, when he was here on sabbatical, he shared with us a funny thing that his Rosh Hashiva back in Israel said, in one of the Hezdi Yeshivas. And the Rosh Hashiva of the Hezdi Yeshiva said that there's a midrash that Avraham Avinu had, a son, Yitzchak, you know, said like a daughter. So if he had a daughter, why not marry the son to the daughter? It's a pre-matan Torah. So that the son married the daughter, and they'll keep it in the family, and everything will be great. But there's a midrash like that, that he was blessed with a daughter. So if that's true, so then let his son marry his daughter. So Rosh Hashiva answered, it's because Yitzchak didn't want to marry a midrash. Okay, so we continue on over here. Okay, Heshiva Kehogin Benizdam Lelo Rivka. So Hashem responded to Eliezer in a proper manner, and Rebecca was sent his way. It was arranged for her to show up. She was healthy and hale, and she was able to handle the job of watering, giving water to the men and the camels, and she wound up becoming the wife of Isaac. So even if he didn't ask her properly, still he was answered correctly, appropriately, and properly by God. How about Shaul ben Kish? How about famous King Shaul? Now, he made an improper promise when he was looking for somebody to fight and kill Goliath, the giant known as Goliath. What did King Saul say that was a little bit on the improper side? What did he say? He said, "V'haya ha'isha she'yakenu, ya'ashrenu ha'melech osher gadol, v'esbito yitemlo." It shall be that the man who slays the giant, well, the king will enrich that person with great wealth, and the king will give him his daughter. So King Shaul is promising his own wonderful daughter to anybody who can come along and kill Goliath, the giant Goliath. Say the rabbis, wait a second. Yochel afilu eved, afilu mamzer. Is it possible that Shaul meant to give his daughter even to a slave? Or even to an illegitimate person? To a mamzer? Is that possible? What's a mamzer? How do you define the word mamzer? Now, you know, colloquially today, among Jews, you call somebody you don't like, that guy's a real mamzer. He messed me over, he stole money from me, I don't like him, I got a title against him, I hate this guy. He's a real mamzer. So, of course, that leads to my little joke that only a Jew can be a mamzer. Because it's true. Only a Jew can be a mamzer. How funny is that? Maybe not that funny. Okay, so here's the footnote. A mamzer, that's a masculine form, or a mamzeret, a feminine form, those are the offspring of a union that's normally punishable by kares or capital punishment. Like a woman who has two husbands. She's married to husband number one. Doesn't want to give her a get. She says, the hell with it. So she runs off and she marries husband number two. And she has a whole family of children with husband number two. But she never got divorced properly from husband number one. Is that a capital crime? I think in Israel, in ancient Israel, it actually was. That's why women are tied down. They are agunas because they're not allowed to marry husband number two unless they're completely free from husband number one. Right? So in ancient Israel, if she didn't get a divorce and she still in all got married to husband number two, and she raised the family, all those children are mamzerim. Not a pleasant thought to think. That they're all mamzerim because they were all born of a union that's worthy of capital punishment. Can't have two husbands for a woman. Polyandry, can you call that? They have more than one husband. Okay, so a mamzer is the offspring of a union punishable by either kares, early death, or capital punishment, or that the children of a mamzer or a mamzeret themselves. They're forbidden in marriage to anybody except a mamzer or a convert or a freed Canaanite slave. Okay, now what about Eliezer? How about in that parsha? How come we don't say, oh, please, you know, Don't send a mamzeres my way. That wouldn't be great, God, to have a mamzeres and bring home a mamzeres. So the footnote says the Gemara doesn't express that concern of a mamzer regarding Eliezer, because Eliezer promised to take a girl from the family of Avraham, in which there was certainly no mamzer concern. So says the Marasha. Do you think of another reason? Right, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Yeah, but it's pre-Matan Torah. Pre-Matan Torah, if you're saying the Midrash, if there's a Midrash that Avraham's daughter can marry Avraham's son, well, that's incestuous. That's not allowed. Okay, maybe that's a capital crime. And if that's true, so you see that pre-Matan Torah, Yaakovinu married two sisters, that's not acceptable. Shvatim, who were they marrying? Local Canaanite girls? Of course not. You think there were 11 girls for 11 brothers in Canaan? And Yitzchak's going to make a shidduch? Well, Yaakov's going to make a shidduch with 11 different Canaanite families? Excuse me, have you lost your senses? Of course not. No such thing. They wound up marrying their own twin sister. Maybe, to make it less problematic, maybe another brother's twin sister. That would be a little bit more palatable. But only by a little bit. I mean, we're talking about semi-incestuous unions over here. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but that's how it is. So this is pre-Matan Torah, and I wouldn't say that anything goes, but a lot went. A lot was going on back then that couldn't happen at the Sinai. So to say that, well, yes, it didn't daven for a mamzer because there was, in that family, there are no mamzer concerns. Are you really? Really? You can be sure that there's no mamzer concerns up in that family up there? Really? How do you know that? The answer is no mamzer concerns anyway, because it seems to me that because it's pre-Matan Torah, the idea of mamzerus has not yet entered the fold, because we're doing stuff, whether we like it or not, there's stuff going on that's going to be later prohibited by the Torah, but not prohibited now. If Avram kept everything and Yitzchak and Yaakov, I get it, but not everything. Not everything. Yaakov kept, married two daughters, two sisters. Not allowed to do that.
Didn't he not want to do that?
Right, he didn't want to do that. That was never his idea. Good point, Mendel. He wanted to only marry Rachel. He only wanted to marry to one woman, and that's it. It wasn't going to be Leah. Leah was never on his radar. And the way Leah, by the way, was, naming children. Oh, ha pama dinu es Hashem, right? We sing that. What is that, a Joey Newcomb song? It's a very nice song. Thank you, Hashem. Thank you, Hashem. Ha pama dinu es Hashem. Whatever the niggin is, it's a nice niggin. And nice words, but they reveal that this time I'm going to thank Hashem. This time I'm going to get some love from my husband. Even Rabbi Shmuel Yaakov Weinberg, the man I used to study with in Baltimore, the Machaber Sefer Beis Ephraim. Even he wondered, what is going on over there? How come she doesn't feel like she's got the love of her husband Yaakov? This time I'm going to be loved. Oh, now. This time I'm really going to be loved. I mean, obviously Leah felt maybe a little bit, that she was a little bit out of the love loop. I don't know. I'm not going to weigh in too much on that. All I know is that even if you believe that they kept Tariq Mitzvahs before Sinai, it's undeniably also true that there was some stuff going on that was not so, Sinaitic. That was not so Torahitic. Okay, so what can you do? At all events, we continue. And the Gemara answers, Heshivo Kehogen, even if Shaul didn't ask appropriately, and theoretically, a mamza could have come along and fought Goliath, and he would have been able to marry the princess. A mamza marrying the princess. That sounds like a Hollywood movie. Okay, or you've got an eved, a slave, marrying a princess. I mean, whoever heard such a thing? So he was asking something a little bit inappropriately, but still a Shiva Kohogan. Still in all, the Almighty answered him in an appropriate manner, v'niz damin lo David. And the Almighty sent David, God sent King, and ultimately King David, God sent David on the way to Shaul. They met, and Shaul said, what are you thinking about? He says, I think I'm going to go. Goliath. He says, I don't think you should. David says, yeah, I think I should. I think I should handle this. And the rest is history. He picked up a rock, took a slingshot, and knocked down the giant.
Okay, so we have two examples of asking for things a little bit inappropriately, but still everything working out just right. What's the third and final instance where somebody asked for something, made a prayer inappropriately, and over there things did not work out well? That's in the case of Yiftach HaGiladi. Yiftach HaGiladi, Yiftach the Gileadite, he made an improper promise before he set out to battle the Ammonites. This, of course, is going to be in Judges chapter 11. We did this years ago. When I first came to town, I was reading an article about Yiftach and the promise that he made. Fascinating article about how, what did he do to his daughter? Well, let me just paint this picture of him. The Chsiv, it's written as follows in Judges 11, that he's praying before he goes out to battle, V'hayah hayotzei asher yetzei midalpein beisi. And so it'll be, whatever comes out from that V'hayah hayotzei asher yetzei midalpein beisi, whatever comes out of the doors of my house, likrasi, towards me, Beshuvi v'shalom ibnei Amon, in my safe return from the children of Amon, v'yala Hashem, it'll be to God, such a thing will be consecrated, it'll go to Hashem, v'halisihu ola, I'm going to lift it up or him up as an ola. Remember, if you want to be really exacting, he's speaking in the masculine. Hayotzei asher yetzei midalsei beisi. V'hayah l'Hashem. V'halisihu. All that is masculine talk. And guess who walked out of his house when he came back from vanquishing the Ammonites? He beat them down. Everybody was so happy in Israel. And who comes out to greet him? I don't know what he was thinking. Was he thinking that an animal is going to come out? I guess so. Because, you know, he was Jewish and he was going to bring a sacrifice. So I guess he was expecting a cow to walk out of his house, or a deer, or a goat, or a sheep, or a lamb, or something along those lines. He's simply expecting a masculine animal is going to walk out of his door, and he's going to then be able to offer that up as a sacrifice. And his daughter walks out. Oh, Gival, this is terrible. My daughter has just walked out the door. Now what am I going to do? What do you mean, now what am I going to do? What do you mean, what are you going to do? What are you thinking? Nothing's going to go on. Oh, no, I got to keep my word. What? You got to keep your word? To whom? To God. I promised God that I was going to offer as a sacrifice whatever walks at my door. And my daughter is not walking out, so I guess I have to slaughter her. What is that sound? Are they getting ready for Rosh Hashanah? That's terrible. It sounds like a cow going to the slaughter. So sad. So sad. Atsuv, as they say in Israel. Atsuv. Sad. Okay, let's see this. Upon Yiftach's return from battle, his daughter ran out of his house to greet him. And so he's got a problem now. Yachol afilu dover tamei. Now, is it possible that Yiftach meant to offer even something unclean? Like a pig or a dog, of course. Only something clean and appropriate is what he's going to offer to Hashem. I mean, you know, he was a judge. Now, he used to hang out with some ruffians. I'm not sure how learned he was, but he was a judge in those days, and he was a military man. And like the rabbis say, Yiftach in his generation, like Shmuel in his, that doesn't mean that they're equal. It means that that's the amount of respect I've got to give them. I have to honor Yiftach HaGiladi in his generation to the same extent that I give respect to Shmuel, the great Samuel the prophet, leagues above everybody. So of course you can easily give him respect. And that's the same respect you've got to give Yiftach, who was also a judge. Was he in the league of Samuel? Of course not. But that's not how I understand the Gemara over there. I understand the Gemara to mean that whatever respect you give this judge, you have to give that judge. Because that's, you respect the rank, not the man. The man's a judge, the man's a judge, and that's it. Right? From Band of Brothers. Sobel, you salute the rank, not the man. He didn't like that, imperative, but he had a following. So Yiftach is now promising, whatever comes out of the doors of my house, I'm going to offer
as a carbon.
So the Gemara asks, I mean, is it possible he's going to offer something completely improper, like a pig or a dog? Was that going to hit his head that he was going to do that? What was he thinking? Obviously, he's only going to offer up something kosher. But you have to, like, you got to spell it out. Yachal afilu davar tamei? Is it possible he was going to offer something improper, unclean, like a pig or a dog? So how does Hashem answer? Heshivu shelo kehog, this is the Gemara. He was answered in a manner that was not optimal, if you will, in an unsatisfactory manner. Instead of Yeshua Kog in an improper manner. God didn't answer him in an improper manner, and he answered him in a less than optimal way. Certainly when your daughter walks out, after you've made a vow, you're going to offer whatever, walks out, and your daughter walks out, your mind has to say, well, not this one, okay? I'm not offering up my daughter as a problem, because of course, that's illegal, it's insane, it's against the Torah, we don't do child sacrifice. But no, he didn't think like that. That was an amazing thing, what's going on over here. Yeshiva Shaloka Hogan, and the Zamer Lobito, and his daughter came out. Behind the Karmelahu Navi, that's what the Navi Yirmiyah said, the Yisrael, the Klai Yisrael, Hatsuri Ein Begilad, in Rofe Ein Sham, is there no balm in Gilad? Is there no doctor there? What does that even mean? And what is Yirmiyah even talking about in chapter 8? So according to the footnote, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is censuring Yiftach for failing, it's very, very famous. He failed to have his vow annulled by the local physician. Who's the local physician? Who went to medical school back then, 3,000 years ago, that Hashem is talking about? Who's Yirmiyah referring to? Who's the local doctor? No doctor. It was Pinchas. Okay? He could have gone to, if you're really the prophet Pinchas. I thought it was the Kohen Gadol. Whatever Pinchas was, I thought it was the Kohen Gadol. Let's go with that. So Yiftach should have said, you know what? I've got to go to the local Kohen Gadol. He will annul my vow. He'll take care of this vow because it's a crazy vow. I don't want to be bound by it, and I'd like to get out of it. I'm going to go to either he's a Navi or he's a Kohen Gadol, and he will get me out of this problem. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do it. Too proud. Pinchas, he could have gone to Pinchas, who was in Gilad, but he did not do that. He failed to have his vow annulled, and that shows Hashem's displeasure with Yiftach's vow. Is there no Baum in Gilad? Is there no position there? Is there Jush? Okay? It says the Midrash in Bereishis Rabbah, chapter 6. Yiftach refused to go to Pinchas. He says, listen, I'm a judge. I'm a ruler. Let Pinchas come to me. Pinchas, for his part, said, I am a prophet. Yiftach should come to me. Both of them, both Yiftach and Pinchas, were punished for this. One should have gone to the other. What happened to Pinchas, I don't really know, but Yiftach was punished. Well, I'm not sure if we know what happened to Pinchas. This is interesting because it's very similar to what went on about 100 years ago in the United States and Germany, where Seligman, a very famous Seligman, a German-Jewish immigrant to the United States in the 1840s, he got into shmatas. He started selling rags, clothing, things like that. And somehow the union found him during the Civil War, and they said, you've got to make some uniforms. And he said, all right, let's make a deal, and I'll make you the uniforms. They said, don't make it out of cardboard. We need really good, proper stuff, because whatever we have is junk. He's okay, I'll make you good stuff. So he takes the order, fulfills the order, provides good uniforms to the union. Then he asks for payment, and the union doesn't have a whole lot of money. It must have been, I don't know, $1 million for all those, you know, however much it was. So they give him an IOU. They'll be able to cash it in. I owe you money, and you'll get the money in 5 years. So Seligman is walking around with a note that the United States of America owes him $1 million. That's the IOU. And there'll be interest paid. Meanwhile, he needs money now. So he says to himself, like, what am I going to do with this? I need cash flow. What is going on? So he asks around people. Think somebody said, why don't you go to shop it around in Europe? Maybe they'll honor it. So he goes to Germany, and he finds a buyer for the note, maybe in London or maybe Frankfurt. Financial census back then. He shows the note. I owe you $1 million. Signed, the United States of America.
at 2% interest. It'll be worth money in 5 years. Be worth $1,200,000 or $20,000. Then make some money on it. Get back your principal and make a few thousand interest. Very good. So he shops it around. Maybe somebody gets $500,000 in cash. Well, you take that, right? You take $500,000 in cash, and the other person's going to make $1 million, but he's going to have to wait 2 or 3 years. So the story goes that Zelman eventually became very wealthy. By providing uniforms to the union, he became very wealthy. You read this in the book, Our Crowd. So he then got into railroads. He became very, very wealthy because railroads are coming up. So he's now in Germany, finds himself at a party. Some duke in Germany is having a party. So he's on one side of the room, and the duke's on the other side of the room. Somebody runs over to Zeligman and says, come, I'll introduce you to the duke, Mr. Zeligman. He says, let him come to me. Imagine that. You're in the duke's party, and you're saying, oh, I don't want to be brought over to him. Let him come to me. So the guy runs back to the duke and says, Mr. Zeligman would like to meet you, but he wants you to come to him. So the duke says, yeah, I don't know about that. This is my party. This is my castle. Let him come to me. Guy runs back to Zeligman and says, the duke's happy to meet you, but you got to go to him. So Zeligman says, that's not how I work. I'm worth a fortune. He's going to have to come to me. And the whole night, neither one met the other. Same thing over here. Human nature is like that. So footnote, Yiftach's vow would have had no validity even if the first thing to greet him was an unclean animal. What if a pig walked out? Doesn't matter what it would have walked out. His vow has no validity. The Amoraim are differing in such a case. If one is obligated to redeem the animal, would you have to take the pig, bring it to market, sell it, get 20 shekel, and with the 20 shekel, you then buy a cow or a goat or a sheep. You have to do that and use the redemption money to purchase the sacrifice? The rabbis differ on that. But all agree that the animal itself, if it's an unclean animal, a treif animal, you don't offer up a pig. Even if you promise to do it, if a pig walks out, you forget it. It doesn't matter what you promise. You're not offering up a pig on a mizbeach. It's unthinkable. Okay? Can't consecrate that as a carbon. Surely a human being is not treated more stringently in such a case. We don't say, well, a pig, we don't let up on the carb on the altar. But a human being, of course we do. Who talks like this? That's insanity itself. There's no such thing as human sacrifice in Judaism. Moreover, in the case of another human being, our scroll says, is also the question of jurisdiction. One cannot consecrate even somebody else's property as a carbon. Surely not his human body. I have no ability to go over to my children or somebody else and say, I'm going to offer you up as a carbon. I don't have any respect over your body. That's your body that you got to take care of. I'm taking care of mine. You take care of yours. I have no shlita. I've got no jurisdiction over your human living, breathing frame. I've got no ability on that. So the fact that he consecrated his own daughter, and obviously he didn't have that in mind, but in his mind, he vowed to consecrating his daughter. Doesn't matter. It's of no consequence, since one does not own the person of his child to this extent. Even if you take care of your children, and you love them, and you clothe them, and you feed them, I have absolutely no right to terminate their lives. That is their life. Hashem gave them. Although the Medrash says that Yiftach should have gone to Pinchas to annul his vow, one should not infer validity of the vow from this. Don't think that there was any validity of the vow. Oh, he's got to go and annul it. He should. He should go and annul it and make sure it's terminated completely. But even if he doesn't, you still can't take any action off of that vow, because the vow itself is ridiculous. It's insane. It's null and void. Even if you don't get it nullified by a Kohen or a Navi, at the end of the day, you still cannot act on it. The Medrash means merely that had Yiftach consulted Pinchas to annul the vow, Pinchas would have ruled it null and void and doesn't need formal annulment. He would have just said, this is literally a nothing burger. You didn't say anything because what you said was not actually fulfilled. Out came your daughter. You're not allowed to kill your daughter. Therefore, the whole thing is ridiculous. Whatever you said 2 months ago has no validity whatsoever. Let's call it a day. Let's go eat lunch. Nothing happened over here because you're not allowed to offer up your daughter to sacrifice. So obviously, whatever you may have said 2 months ago is rendered null and void.
The footnote continues. This is where it gets fun. However, Yitzchak and his daughter mistakenly believed that the vow was binding. Therefore, Yitzchak's daughter remained celibate for the rest of her life in fulfillment of the vow. That's the Radak. According to some other commentators, Yitzchak actually sacrificed his daughter. See the Ramban. What's going on over here is the Spanish school, the Ralbag, I think the Ibn Ezra and the Radak, they all follow a certain shita that, no, he didn't kill her. He simply did not allow her to get married. And in so doing, she remained celibate. And if she remained celibate, it's like he killed her. Because by not letting her get married and having have children of her own, it's like effectively terminating her life. It's the equivalent of it. And that's how the Spanish school goes. The Ashkenazi school doesn't go in that line. And they follow, you know what they follow? They follow the Talmud and the Midrash. Because I looked this up and I had to give a share. The Talmudim and the Midrashim are unanimous. He executed her. Yes, he did sacrifice her. And that's why he was punished. Plus it says that he was buried in this town, that town, and this town and that town. What do you mean he was buried in four towns? How many towns can a human corpse be buried in? Usually one. That's usually where the human body is interred, right? In one place. Not over here. He was losing limbs. He lost an arm here, lost a leg there, another arm there, a leg over there. And that, and Nebuch, he became like a home plate. I mean, he wound up having no arms and no legs. He's a quadriplegic or whatever. I mean, he literally had no limbs. And that explains, the rabbi said, that explains why it says he was buried in the towns in the Galil or the Gilad area, whatever. Wherever in Israel he was buried, he was not buried in one place. His limbs were buried in four different places. So what's going on with the Spanish school? Why would they even say it? Where are they getting it from? We're getting to say if the Talmudim and the Midrashim are all unanimous that he killed her. Because the Pasuk says he did to her as he said he would. Well, he said he was going to kill her. So then what's the question? Where do you have to have some other idea? Answer, the Karaites came up with it. Amazingly, the Spanish school follows a Karaite scholar who's of the opinion that Yitzchak did not kill his daughter. He simply put her outside the town in a little hut, and he made her not get married. And they fed the daughter, and she lived, and she didn't get married. Now, why would the Spanish school follow that? Why would rabbis living in Spain follow that? The answer is because that's what they saw. According to Josh Berman, who wrote the article, that's what they saw around them in Catholic societies. Sure, there's a monastery for men. Sure, there's a nunnery for women. But what if there's like one individual woman who, for whatever reason, I don't know why, she's not appropriate for a nunnery, not really cut out to be in a convent. She wants to be, or she's supposed to be, all by herself. So they saw that also in Catholic Spain 1,000 years ago. They saw how the local bishop would put a girl into a little house or whatever. She'd be all by herself. We'll feed her. And she'd get by day to day. They'd give her food to eat. So that's his theory. And it derives out of a Karaite who said that it's not like the little definition that he killed her. Rather, he didn't let her get married. And the Spanish school picks it up. Amazingly, what happens historically is that a Karaite, normally a literal reader of the Bible, he goes midrashic. And the rabbis, who are normally darshaning and midrashic oriented and so on, they go literal. So everybody is switching hats over here. It's just absolutely incredible. And that was the chaf at the end of the shir, that the Karaites go rabbinic and the rabbis go karaitic. And it is layehidim hoysa oyu. I mean, it is a fun day for the Jewish people when the rabbis become Karaites and the Karaites become rabbis. That is a strange world I'm living in. Okay, what time is it? Where are we holding? 11:11. We have 4 more minutes. Great. Uchsiv. Asher lo tzivisi v'lo dibarti v'lo osal libi. Okay. There's a scriptural source where in Jeremiah chapter 19, verse 5, God is quoted as saying, I have not commanded, I have not spoken, nor has it entered my mind. And what's that talking about? That's talking about, you know, whatever the context is, it is.
But the drush is that Hashem is talking about Yiftach and his daughter. That whatever, you know, he had in mind, I never commanded it. I didn't want him to offer up his daughter. I never said that out loud. I never entered my head that I should encourage or have somebody offer up a child as a sacrifice. God says, don't blame me. I mean, I'm into child sacrifice. Okay? Child sacrifice is one of the cardinal sins of the Avodah Zarah people. They have built the altars of Baal to burn their children with fire to Baal, which I have not commanded, nor spoken, nor has it entered my mind. God never commands such a thing. And certainly didn't command in regards to Yiftach. Okay? Now this threefold expression, which I have not commanded, nor spoken, nor has it entered my mind, that's a reference to three historical instances. Ashelo TBC, which I have not commanded, Zeb and Osho, Mesha of Melech Moab. That refers to the case of the son of Mesha, king of Moab. Shinemalek, it says, V'ikachas b'no ha'bachor she'yimlok tachto v'yaleo ola. There is the pasuk in, where is it? In 2 Kings, chapter 3. Pasuk over there says, and he, meaning Mesha, the king of Moab, he took his firstborn son, who was to rule in his place, and he offered him up as a burnt offering. God says, I never wanted that. That's not part of my plan. Okay, that's crazy. I don't want that. I share the CBC. I never commanded that. What are you doing? Below Dibarati, nor have I ever spoken of such a thing. Ze Yiftach. That's our Yiftach and, Yiftach HaGiladi, who offers up his daughter as a sacrifice. I never said that he should do such a thing. But also Levi, and never entered my heart, heart that a child should be sacrificed. Ze Yitzchak ben Avraham. That's the Akedah. Hashem was merely testing Abraham. He never wanted him to actually kill Yitzchak, because God doesn't believe in child sacrifice. Finds it repugnant. Okay, God does not believe in human sacrifice. Some of the human beings are going to die for somebody else's sins. What does that sound like? Sounds like some religion I'm familiar with. Well, in our opinion, God finds that repugnant because you live a life, you do good things, you do bad things, you're responsible. Just because I keep driving, somebody once said, I think, Prager and Talushka, in their 9 questions people ask about Judaism, they write, just because I keep the driver's laws 30 years ago, does that mean that in the future nobody's got to keep driver's laws? As you drive a car, you can break every rule in the book. Why? Because I was an excellent driver. Therefore, you can be a terrible driver. That's not how the world works. Can you imagine if this Christian idea was applied to driving on the road? You're going to have accidents every second. Nobody would ever take a test. No driver's ed. No getting behind the wheel. No proving to the state that you know how to drive a vehicle. Just do whatever you want. Put the key in the ignition. You're 17 years old. You have no idea what you're doing. Go drive a car. Who does that? It's crazy. A state could never allow that. Accidents every minute. Everybody would be getting killed. So the whole thing is crazy. The whole belief system is nuts that they've got. So at all events, it's as the prophet Jimmy ends off. Also, Levi. See, it's because been Avram. That's the Akedah. Hashem never intended for Avram to actually slaughter his son. Okay? And let's finish it off. Amar Rabbi Barachia. This is where the rain comes in. Afkenes is a shor, shalom, shalom, kogan. Even Yisrael, even the congregation of Israel, made an improper request. Because Baruch Hu is Shiva Kogan. But the Almighty cut him a break, and he answered them in an appropriate, positive, acceptable, upstanding, wonderful manner. How so? Shinemar says, the Nedar near the Faladas is Hashem. A pasuk in Hosea, the prophet Hosea, where the Jewish people say, let us know, let us pursue the knowledge of God. Kishachar Nachron Motza'o. His going forth is sure as the morning. V'yavo kageshem lanu. And he shall come to us like the rain. See that word? Ding, ding, ding. There's the rain. Okay? Let's get to know the Almighty. Let's pursue knowledge of God. His going out is as sure as morning. In the bokeh, the morning. V'yavo, and his coming back, kageshem lanu, is like the rain to us. End quote of the prophet. Says our scroll, Israel was requesting of Hashem that the Almighty resemble the rain. Let him be like the rain. In other words, as known to humanity as the rain. Let God reveal himself to such an extent like the rain is known to humanity. What does that mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? You look at when it's the rainstorm, you look at it, what do you see? It's rain. Okay? What's happening? It's raining.
Yoreh Geshem, it's raining out there. Yeah? Well, tell me more. What do you mean? What more is there to tell you? It's raining out there. Oh, yeah? What's it hitting? Everything. The streets, the vegetation, the trees, the houses, everybody gets hit by the rain. Okay? There's not much more to say. So I want to know God. Christ said, let us please know you, Hashem. Like the same way that we know the rain. It's easy to know rain. Even little children understand rain. So we want to get to know you on that level. That like it'll be, we want to have such a deep and intimate knowledge of you, God. No more secrets of you. You can't keep secrets from us. Reveal to us everything about you, like you're the rain. God says, yeah, that's not a really appropriate thing for you to ask me, because, listen, you know, my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. You know, there are secrets about me I'm never going to reveal. So I'm not going to be like the rain to you. Hashem said to the Jewish people, B.T., my daughter, at she'elet davar she'pa'amim mitbakesh, she'pa'amim eino mitbakesh. You request something which at times is desirable, at times not desirable. Okay? I mean, there are times I'm going to reveal myself a little bit, and you'll see how I operate, and you'll understand, I guess, after the fact. Moshe said, show me your front, and I'll, you know, meaning, show me what's going on, and I'll understand you. Shai says, nah, not so fast. I'll let you see my back, meaning you'll make sense out of things once they've already occurred. And that's kind of what history is. Things that happened years ago, we don't get to understand it. 20, 30 years later, you see a trend forming. You understand why he did what he did and how that resulted 20, 30 years later. Sometimes that's how it is. So Hashem says, my daughter, you're going to request something which is times is okay, desirable. Sometimes not so desirable. Rain is not a benefit at all times. For in the summer, it's not good. It's detrimental. But I have decided I'm still going to be something to you which is desirable at all times. Shneim like it says, Eyeh katal Yisrael. I shall be like the dew to Israel. I was learning it wrong. When I said that Hashem is going to not reveal himself, it was true that Hashem doesn't reveal the secrets, but still is going to be like the rain, but not exactly like the rain, which sometimes is detrimental. We don't want rain in the summertime, only in the rainy season in Israel. Hashem says, I'm not going to be like the rain. Rather, Pasuk says, Eyeh katal l'Yisrael. I'm going to be like the dew, D-E-W, like the dew, like the tal to Israel, because dew is desirable all year long, even all year round, even in the summertime. You get dew in Israel. Hashem sends the dew every single morning. Hashem says, I'm going to be like dew to Israel. And you'll get to know me like that, and you'll begin to understand me. The more you learn, the more you get to know me, what I want. I'll be like the dew to Israel. Okay. Ba'ot shalosh shalo kogen, and Firestorm made another improper request of Hashem, Amr lefonav. And Israel said to Hashem, Ribono shel olam, simeini kachosam al libecha, kachosam al zeroecha. A pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. Place me like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm. That is Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 6. Place me like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm. That's where I want you to put us. Now, there is a midrash like that, that Hashem wears tefillin praising Israel, and we wear tefillin praising God. There is a midrash, something along those lines. But let's see what the Gemara says over here in Tainus. Amalar Kodesh Baruch Hu, B.T., my daughter, Israel. But isn't that something when he wants to talk about? Hashem talks about us as B'ni B'chol Yisrael. My firstborn son is Israel. Over here, Hashem is calling Israel B.T., my daughter. So which is it? My son or my daughter? Which one? Both? I think I have another question.
Well, maybe the question is the kind of question that a daughter would ask.
Okay, maybe. That's good. You're requesting something, Hashem says to Israel, which at times can be seen and other times cannot be seen. Okay? And for example, I'm just fleshing it out, a seal placed on somebody's heart. How can you see such a thing? If you're wearing a cloak, if you're wearing tzitzis, you're wearing a shirt, an undershirt, like you do, how are you going to see a seal that is placed on the heart? How are you going to see something that's placed on the arm? Often people wear long sleeve shirts, or they wear coats, or they wear sweaters, or whatever, jackets, whatever they're wearing, covering up their arms. So if that's the case, so how am I ever going to, you know, you want me to reveal something, I should wear you like something that's clearly visible to the naked eye, you know, because I'm not going to, God's not going to wear the equivalent of a spiritual jacket or put us on your heart. What do you mean? In the human mind, putting something on the heart is normally going to be covered up because people cover up their chests and many people cover up their arms and they only expose their face to the rest of humanity. So how can you expect Hashem to be any more visible than your typical human being is visible? How do you expect Hashem to do that? In fact, Hashem said, you request something which at times can be seen, sometimes cannot be seen. Sometimes I put something on the arm, and I wear a short sleeve shirt, so you can't see something on the arm. But other times, no. Whoever says, I'm going to work with you, I'm going to make you, I'm going to make something of you which can be seen at all times. I'm going to make something of Klal Yisrael which I can see at all times, which are always going to be visible. Even to me, God, to which everything is always, of course, visible. But the symbolism is, Shemak, it says, Hein al kapayim chakosich, as it says in Isaiah chapter 49, behold, on the palms of my hands, I have engraved you. And says the footnote, Rashi, unlike his chest or his arms, a person's hands are visible at all times. So that's how Hashem is going to deal with us. He's going to engrave us on the palms of his hands symbolically, and therefore we're always going to be in his eyesight, we're always going to be front and center. The Almighty doesn't have, you know, a chest and arms and so on. He doesn't have a human frame, a human body. We're told that four times in the Tanakh. Lo ish kel, where God is not a man. Okay? So we know that Hashem is not a man. But symbolically and midrashically, prophetically, Hashem says, I'm going to describe you, Klal Yisrael, on the palms of my hands. And just like a human being, it doesn't really cover up his hands. They're exposed. Okay? His hands and fingers are exposed. He can, you know, work with his hands and feed himself and so on. So Hashem is going to do the same thing. He's going to put Klal Yisrael in the palms of his hands and they'll always be visible. Alternatively, Rashi explains that the word kapayim means the sky. Hashem therefore engraved a human image, in this case, majestically a representative of a representation of Yaakov on the heavenly throne in the sky. There is some image like that. Hashem sits on the throne, and on the throne is engraved the image of Yaakov Avinu. Okay? So therefore, Hashem is asked in a way that may be not so great, placing like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm, and Hashem says, can't really fulfill that, because there are times when I'm not going to, you know, if you're going to ask me to do that, like a human being. A human being, you can't see it usually on the chest, because it's covered up. On the arm, someone's available to, you know, for viewing, someone's not. Hashem says, I'll do you one better. Even if you didn't ask properly, I will answer you appropriately and properly. I'll make you. I'll engrave you in the palms of my hands. And those are always visible. Hands are always visible. And if I'm always going to see Klal Yisrael, and I'll always be loving. I want to, then you get the last question.
Even Hashem will tell him. So yeah.
Sure. Like I said earlier, right? You know, one message at a time, Mendel. One message at a time, and if you want to combine the Joshua, then you have to go to somebody with a higher pay scale to reconcile it all. I wish everybody a good Shabbos. Thanks for staying a little bit overboard. Thank you, Zun. Have a great Shabbos. And Mr. Shem, we'll see everybody Sunday morning for our weekly Midrash class at 9:45 a.m. So please come and join us for that. The Talmud continues on Monday morning. We'll continue on Titus 4a. Thank you so much. Have a great Shabbos and enjoy. So Popska signing off now. Thank you, Jake and Mitch, for all you do for GMS, Gulf Mountain Synagogue, and our School of Jewish Studies. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.